You are Locked On Hawks, your daily Atlanta Hawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 367 of the Locked On Hawks podcast. I am your host, Brad Rowland, coming to you live on a Tuesday morning, which is a little bit of a weird statement to make. And joining me for the first time in a week, it's been a while, it's Jeff Siegel. What's up, Jeff?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm all right. I should tell people that Jeff is braving the elements of a very early morning on the West Coast to help me out with this podcast. I didn't want to make everybody wait even longer. It's been more than a week since I recorded a podcast, which is crazy, but I was traveling internationally, and as I said before I left, it was all going to come down to situation, and frankly, I never had the internet capacity to record a podcast. So here we are, and a lot to catch up on. I'm not going to bore everybody with a game-by-game breakdown of all four games that we missed while I was gone, but you know, three losses and a win against Orlando. We can go through them a little bit if you want to, but a couple of unsurprising results in Houston, Minnesota, followed by a home loss to Philly and a win over Orlando. I guess big picture is probably a good place to start. What did you take away from these four games, other than the fact that Karl-Anthony Towns is very good at basketball?
Yeah, he was very good, and that the Hawks didn't particularly seem interested in guarding him, especially outside. Like, he would pick and pop, and they weren't even faking like they were going to guard him. Nobody even got within 10 feet of him on most of his three-pointers, and he made a bunch of them. If he goes 2 for 8, you know, the Hawks might win that game, but he went like 6 for 8, and he had 56 and 15, you know. So it was just, you know, one of those games where he made all of his open shots. It seemed like they were sort of content with him taking those shots, and they were happy to let him do it. It was almost like the old Dwight Howard thing where you let him take his shots and you lock off everybody else. Back when Dwight was on the Magic, that was like a strategy that a lot of teams employed. And it seemed like the Hawks did that against Towns, and Towns made him pay. And, you know, maybe next time they won't, or, you know, maybe next time he won't or whatever. But he was fantastic, obviously, and scoring at all three levels, but it was really the three-pointers where it was very stark, and it was very obvious that the Hawks were like, yeah, take as many of those as you want, even though you're very good at them, and you hit all of them. You know, he was like five for his first five, and then he, you know, only made one of his last three, but it was, you know, he was fantastic. And so, I think the 56 was flattered him in terms of his performance a little bit, just because the Hawks were like, take as many shots as you want, have as many points as you want. We're going to lock off everybody else, which is a weird strategy against the Timberwolves, where, you know, especially without Butler, that they're not particularly well spaced out. They don't have a lot of other threats, you know, but that was the strategy, and it didn't work.
Yeah, that's well said. Just for a little bit of a look behind the curtain, I was watching these games at very odd hours. I watched one of them on the plane on the way home. Everything was kind of messed up in my schedule. But watching this one, I obviously knew what happened beforehand, so I was at a close eye on Towns, and I would definitely echo what you're saying there. It was a whole lot of defensive indifference, which is a little bit strange. Obviously, he finished with 56 points, 15 rebounds on 19 of 32 shooting. You know, the 32 is kind of says it all, in addition to the 15 in free throw attempts. So he had a ton of usage, and obviously when you're cooking like that, it doesn't really matter. But the Hawks defense was not good in that game. Offensively, actually, they were quite good. They shot 51% from the floor, 53% from the floor, 48% from three. Had a great offensive game aside from 20 turnovers, which is never good. But by the way, we should at least mention Mike Muscala had a career high in that game against the T-Wolves with 24 points on 10 shots. So he was good offensively, nothing else. You know, and before that, I was actually en route to my destination when the Hawks were taking on the Rockets. We'll breeze through that game quite quickly. Isaiah Taylor had the game of his life with 26 against Houston. But, you know, going into Houston, even without Chris Paul, there was no expectation that the Hawks were going to win that game. And basically from the jump, it was over. It was 33-20 at the end of the first quarter, and it was all Houston in that game. Anything stand out to you in that Houston game? I don't think necessarily anything would jump out to me aside from Taylor's performance. And I guess Tyler Dorsey was a little bit active. I mean, not terribly efficient, but at least he had sort of a bigger game off the bench.
Yeah, I mean, the Houston game, by maybe 8 to maybe 6 minutes left in the second quarter, that it was over. Like, it was clear that the Rockets were on a whole nother level. And even without Chris Paul, it was just this was a mid-tier college team taking on a high school team. It was just dominant. And Taylor, played fine. I mean, he was really aggressive against his old team, but it was, you know, he got so much of his action in, you know, essentially what was garbage time. The entire second half was garbage time. And so, like, it's hard to say, like, oh, yeah, Taylor really took a step forward, even though he put up a career high. It was like, yeah, let's, you know.
He was okay.
The Rockets knew. Yeah, the Rockets knew by the end of the second quarter, like, okay, this game's over. Let's move on.
Yeah, I mean, they had no incentive to try terribly hard in that second half, considering the game was fully put away. But we should at least hit on that. So we've now done that, and that is that. Moving quickly, and I promise we're going to go more in depth on a couple of things, but I want to get through these four games real quickly. The Sixers game was back at home, and it looks like the Hawks only lost this game by 10 points, and that's on the bright side. But this game was much more lopsided than that in the second half. A really bizarre third quarter versus fourth quarter. The third quarter was 39-18. Philly, and the fourth quarter was 32-15 Hawks. So obviously the third quarter meant more than the fourth, because by the time that third quarter ended, it was long over. But a little bit of a weird game. If you look at the box score and ignore these quarter-by-quarter breakdown, you might think the Hawks were hanging around here, but for the most part, again, it was pretty much all Philly. And by the way, this is without Joel Embiid, so this is a weakened Philly on the road. And, you know, the Hawks were without Dennis Schroeder, who we'll talk about in a little bit here, but not a great performance either at home.
Yeah, that was it was pretty poor. I think it was just, you know, one of those things where they were on the road for a while. That first game home can sometimes be a bit of a letdown. Ben Simmons was doing Ben Simmons stuff, and it was just they didn't really have the juice to handle them. I think the 3-point shooting against the 76ers sort of fell off a cliff. We talked about Minnesota, how they were 13 for 27. I think they were 9 for 39 against the Sixers. Oof. And that's, you know, obviously never going to get it done. There was a lot of attempts. That's great. But, you know, a few more of those have to go down before you're actually doing that very well. You know, and obviously Taylor was the only healthy point guard. We'll get into that because Majette was up in Erie for their playoff game. And so, yeah, and Taylor tried his best, but was not very good. He finished 5 for 18, which actually is way better than he actually was, because he made his last three shots at garbage time, and like really garbage time, like right at the end of the game as they closed it to 10. So really he was like 2 for 15 in the competitive portion of the game, which is terrible. And I think Tyler Dorsey was pretty poor in that game too. Like everybody who like tried to handle the ball just was not good, and it just didn't work against Philly. You know, it was interesting to see how Philly's defense looked without Joel Embiid, and they were, I mean, obviously this is the Hawks, and so, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but they were just as good defensively as even, you know, as they would be with Embiid out there.
Yeah, this is a weird game, and it was incredibly fast-paced, but really bad offense on both sides, actually. You know, old friend Ursula Ilyasova had a huge game with 21 and 16, and Ben Simmons was really good, obviously, for Philly. But the Hawks actually had a 95.4 defensive rating in this game, so they were actually good defensively. It was just one of those things where offensively they actually took 101 shots, which is a crazy number. You don't often see the triple-digit field goal attempts in a regulation game, so that kind of speaks to the fast pace. But the Hawks were, you know, pretty bad in general, and defensively, I'm not sure how much of that effectiveness had to do with the Hawks offense versus the Philly offense just kind of sputtering a little bit. But yeah, it's one of those things where a pretty ugly performance in a lot of ways, even if it was explainable. Although we should say Damian Lee with 20 points. So shouts to Damian Lee, who we'll talk about here in a second. He was the leading scorer for the Hawks. And actually, the leading scorer in the game, aside from Ursula Ilyasova, was Damian Lee. And that's something that you would not have projected, of course, coming into the game. We can move on to the fourth and final game. That was the Orlando Magic game, and the only positive result for the Hawks. This game was awful, which I'm sure we can discuss here, and not exactly a great result for the Hawks if you are a fan of the tank race, because this was a tanking versus tanking extravaganza at home, and the Hawks were able to emerge with the victory 94-88, a pretty ugly basketball game in really every way. I'm not even sure what I would take away from this game other than the fact that the Hawks won and Dwayne Dedmon was good, but aside from that, yeah, I don't know, man.
Yeah, I think Dedmon was good. I think they sort of curtailed the turnovers after. So I mean, 14 is still not great, but like
it's not 22 sort of, or whatever.
Yeah, I mean it's not 20 plus, which they've had a few times this year. It's hard to take too much away from it. Dorsey played well again. You know, that's the second time in a few games that he played, you know, particularly, you know, decently at least offensively. And so, you know, it's nice to see him sort of get going. Obviously, he's given most of that back on the defensive end, but you know, at least he's providing his worth on the offensive end.
For sure. And we could probably leave it there in terms of just actual results. I will say, as we transition into some news and some more analysis stuff here, DeAndre Bembry returned in that game for the first time in a long time. He had missed, you know, several games with the abdominal strain after basically missing the whole season with various maladies. You know, Bembry actually did come back and play 3 games in February that everybody forgot. In fact, when I said that he had played again, I think it was February 23rd, which is the previous time, and people were surprised that it had been that recently. He had that 3-game stretch around the All-Star break where he came back. But even before that, he was out for a long time. What did you see from DeAndre in his first game back, and what are you looking for, I guess, more importantly, over these next, you know, 4 or 5 games here, that he'll hopefully be healthy? Because obviously it's been sort of a lost season for him.
Yeah, it's a completely lost season for him, but I'm still looking for him to be sort of quick and active on defense and the playmaking. You know, you hope that that's sort of still there, that he's still up to speed, you know, especially conditioning wise. He only played 14 minutes. That's solid. That's a good sort of, as he ramps himself up, I think that's good for him. But, you know, you're just hoping that some of that stuff is still there. You know, I would assume, you know, the vision was still there. He had 3 assists in just those 14 minutes. I thought he played well on the offensive end, even though, you know, he missed badly on the 1 3-point shot he took. The 3-pointer still looks flat and not very good. But, you know, the playmaking was there, the sort of getting into the lane and finding others, you know, in a passing, you know, especially now that we've seen this team for a few weeks without Dennis Schroeder, you know, having somebody who, you know, can pass the ball even at Schroeder's level, it was nice to see, because Prince, you know, who's gotten a lot of the primary ball handler responsibilities, is not, you know, just not the passer that even Bembry or Schroeder is. And so, you know, you saw that on the offensive end. On the defensive end, he can still move his feet. He still was cutting guys off on the drives and stuff. And so, you know, I think he played well on the defensive end. And so I'm hoping, you know, just ramp him up a little more. You know, the 3-point shot is not going to come around this year in these last few games, but that's the, you know, obviously the biggest thing to work on over the summer.
Yeah, and I just think DeAndre playing, I mean, I think it was sort of telling earlier, this is probably a month ago now, but when Budenholzer was asked about Bembry, I think even by me or Michael Cunningham, somebody asked him about Bembry's recovery, and Bud kind of said, you know, the most important thing is just him being able to play, which is kind of a, you know, a more candid statement from Bud than you're used to seeing. But I think you can sense the organizational frustration with Bembry not being able to stay on the floor. And there are obviously, you know, parts of his game, the jump shot is one, and the fact that, you know, the facilitation stuff was his calling card offensively, but that is not even necessarily been present a whole lot this year. There were times where he was basically unplayable offensively early in the year, when he was healthy. That's frustrating. Defensively, I've been very encouraged by what we've seen from Bembry, but he's not a guy that's going to be good enough on that end of the floor to justify being a bad offensive player. He's going to have to be at least an average offensive player to sustain. And I think, you know, defensively, if he was 2 inches taller, a little bit thicker, maybe he'll be a sort of a stopper on the wing. But because he's a little bit more frail, he's more of a combo defender. He can be very good on that end, but he's going to have to do something very well offensively, whether it be facilitate or at least have a passable jump shot to have a path. So, I mean, there's lots of evaluation to be done in these last 5 games, because for as much as the Hawks necessarily aren't hoping to win a ton of games, the guys who are playing are going to be playing hard, and Bembry has every incentive to go ahead and play well, at least play hard and invest big time in terms of his performance in the next 5 games. So plenty to evaluate there, because he's one of the few guys we just haven't seen this year enough to take away. Because, you know, some of these guys, you know, Torian Prince, even John Collins, who I want to ask you about here in a second, is we've seen those guys enough now to where a 5-game sample wasn't going to sway me a ton. With Bembry, we just not seen a ton, so he actually has probably more to prove than almost anybody, including the guys who are on the periphery, because of the fact that he just hasn't played very much.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they've obviously already picked up his third year option for next year, so they're gonna, you know, he'll be on the team next year.
The fourth year option's coming.
Yeah, but his fourth year option's coming, and it's like, you know, you at some point you do need to, you know, show something that you can, that they want to pick up that fourth year option. Obviously, he'll have summer league, which I assume he'll probably play again, and the training camp before that option decision is due. But, you know, he's on the fringe of pretty much being out of the league, which is really unfortunate to say, because obviously he's been struck with injuries and everything, but, you know, it is what it is at this point.
I do think he'll get a chance somewhere, if it's not with the Hawks after next year. But your point is accurate in that right now, with what we've seen, it's not a lock that he's an NBA player, which is, you know, that's unfortunate for a first round draft pick. I'm not closing the door on Bembry yet. I think we just need to see him healthy. But if he can't stay healthy at some point, that's also a, you know, I'm not sure it's a skill, but it's something you have to have to be able to stay healthy and just play consistently. And he's not necessarily shown that either. We can move on from there. Sort of the big headliner while I was gone, while we were not doing podcasts, is Dennis Schroeder in two different ways. He's out for the year, which is not a big surprise. He shut down with the ankle. I was shocked when he came back in the game against Golden State, and since then he has not played. So that's not a big surprise that he was shut down. The Hawks have no incentive to push him, of course, in terms of health because of the season and the way that things have gone. And of course, the other thing is that there's a development in his legal case where he could be charged with a felony. There was a recommendation in that way, and this is a long way from now, but if he was convicted of felony, he would obviously have a mandatory suspension from the NBA. I think there's discipline going to be coming at some point, almost regardless of what happens here, but the Hawks are going to let the legal process play out. Do you have any thoughts on the legal stuff before we get into the actual play of Schroeder, or is it something to just kind of just leave on and sort of hold your breath to see what happens?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just something to monitor, something to see, you know, how it develops. We have no real insight into how that process will play out. If it's, you know, obviously if he's convicted of a felony, then that's obviously a very big deal.
That'd be bad.
But I guess we can speculate that, like, oh, the fact that the DA or the assistant DA or whoever recommended that it be escalated from a misdemeanor to a felony, like, obviously that's not a great sign.
Yeah, I mean, the victim had, what was it, torn ACL, torn meniscus, and, you know, I'd be pretty surprised if Dennis Schroeder was convicted of a felony, frankly, because if it got to that point, you usually would probably see a plea of some sort. I'd be pretty stunned if he was actually convicted of a felony, but at the same time, the elevation of that is just, it's not great. Kind of, regardless of whether it actually ends up being a conviction, the fact that it was escalated in that way, or at least recommended to that way, probably does not speak very well of what happened.
Yeah, I don't, you know, it's something to monitor, obviously, but it's obviously not a great situation for Schroeder.
To be sure. As for the player, I don't want to do too much of a postmortem here. We'll have plenty of time to do that after the season. But Schroeder is, of course, done for the year. He finishes the season averaging 19.4 points and 6.2 assists per game, which obviously, you know, sounds pretty good on paper. But efficiency-wise, there were some issues. A 29% three-point shooting clip is not great at all, obviously. And defensively, as of this moment, of course, the season's not over yet for everybody else, but he is number 496 out of 509 in terms of ESPN's defensive RPM. So that kind of speaks to how bad he was defensively, and the Hawks allowed like 110 points per 100 possessions with him on the court this season defensively. So there were highs and lows. If you want to look at the bright side, he had a career high PER. That's good. Had huge usage, a career high usage, 30.4% usage rate. So some of that's if you want to make a positive argument, you could probably do that. If you want to make a negative argument, I can certainly do that. So I mean, without getting too deep into this, kind of how are you feeling about Schroeder now versus maybe even a couple months ago? Because, you know, it was a full season from him. It was only 67 games, but at the same time, we kind of saw, you know, a lot of highs, a lot of lows.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing over the last couple of weeks, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, like the fact that he's missing really shows up, obviously, on the offensive end in the way that, like, they just don't. He brings a lot of that offensive juice that, even though we have a lot of problems with the way he plays offense, like, he just, the fact that he can get to the rim whenever he wants to, the fact that he finished, you know, relatively decently this year, like, it wasn't, you know, in that sense, he was solid this year, but, you know, almost in every other sense, he didn't take a step forward like I had wanted him to, like I had expected him to, really, especially coming off that Eurobasket performance. I really thought that he was going to, you know, step up and be more of a playmaker for his teammates. Obviously, he averaged, you know, 6.2 assists, which I think is just 0.1 less than last year, 0.1 off of his career high. It's not, yeah, he had the ball in his hands a whole lot more because of that high usage rate. So it's not, you know, you can look at that, but you can also see, like, he had more opportunities to pass the ball than he did. And, you know, he's not playing with the best teammates in the world, so maybe there were some trust issues there with some of his teammates. But, you know, I would have liked to see him take a step forward in some way. And obviously, I guess he took a step forward with the usage and still being able to score. But, you know, we talked about the efficiency wasn't very good. And the playmaking wasn't there, and the defense was a crime against humanity all year. And, you know, there's nothing, none of that improved over the course of the year. None of that improved over the last few months. And so, you know, the team is worse off without him, you know, on the offensive end, but it's not because he was some sort of, you know, world beater on either end of the floor, really.
Yeah, I do think, you know, positively, his mid-range shooting was good this year, which is something that, I think that's probably even sustainable for him now. He shot, I believe it's 47% on mid-rangers, which is very good for a point guard. On the negative side, 29% from three is ugly in a lot of ways. I think you would like to see some movement in that. Obviously, you know, last year, 34% on threes, which is nothing to write home about. But if you could just do that, it would be just fine. But 29% is kind of untenable, frankly, with as much as he's shooting. You know, some of that's probably just bad shots and the fact that he had to take a lot of shots. But 29% for a full season is troubling in some ways, especially if you thought, and I think I probably did, that the 34% represented a step forward last year from three. He's never going to be a knockdown shooter. It's the form. It's the way that he shoots. It's just never going to be that kind of thing. But I'm hoping that the mid-range growth and the fact that he's now back-to-back season shot 46 and 47% from mid-range, hopefully that can extend out to three-point range, because you know the mid-range is definitely a weapon in his arsenal that he absolutely needs because of his frail stature when compared to some other guys. But he's going to have to be better as a three-point shooter in order to be the type of offensive player that he needs to be. And defensively, it's just a huge disappointment. I think I've said that obviously too many times at this point, but he's just been really bad defensively. There were some moments in the second half of the season where he gave better effort, and you could see full games where I would probably call his defense, you know, coherent, nothing to write home about, and that's fine. If he's just okay, that's okay. He's a starting point guard in the NBA, probably a lower end one to be sure, but a starting point guard in the NBA if his defense is okay. But it's not been okay for the vast majority of this season, and he just can't live in that way. So I'll be interested to see on a number of levels, obviously the legal stuff. The contract stuff, the Hawks might have to go away from him at some point in time because, you know, the GM did not draft Dennis Schroeder or pay Dennis Schroeder. So we kind of don't know how Travis Lang feels. I think if I was in his shoes, I'd be trying to get him off this roster as fast as possible. There's a certain break-even point where it's not worth it to trade him. But at the same time, that's something to monitor too. So he's potentially one of the more intriguing guys, even though he's one of the only guys signed long-term on the team. He's also one of the intriguing guys when it comes to whether he'll actually be around, because there's every reason to think that you may not want him to be. So, a lot to monitor in the next couple of months for Dennis Schroeder. Of course, nothing's going to happen until the draft at the very earliest, but when it comes to a trade or something like that. But just some stuff that's sort of lingering out there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do with him long term. And obviously, they have these three first-round picks probably in this draft. We still have to see whether Minnesota makes the playoffs. But assuming they do, the Hawks will have three firsts and their high second-rounder in this draft. They've got some incoming picks in the future. You know, using one of those maybe to get off a Schroeder, I think you would have to use two of them at this point, but maybe there's somebody out there who, you know, values what he can bring to the table, and you can get off of him for like a first and a second in sort of a money dump in that sense. But, you know, the Hawks, I don't know that that's even really makes sense for them in a sense that they're not looking to compete right now. So is dumping money really the best way to go about it? By the time his contract ends, that's when they'll be sort of ramping back up, and then they can just leave, you know, they can just dump him by having his contract end. And so I'm not sure that they are, you know, will really take anything seriously unless they can get off of him for something really small. Then they can go ahead and do that. But, you know, I'm not sure that it makes a bunch of sense to get off of him at this point.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, 3 years and $46.5 million guaranteed. It could actually even be more than that with incentives. So, yeah, just something to monitor there when it comes to Schroeder. A couple other things that we could probably go quicker on. Damian Lee signed a rest of the season contract while I was away. That contract does not have a non-guarantee for next year, though, in the way that the other ones that the Hawks have done so far have. So I guess I'll defer to you on this one as the salary cap guru in terms of why this would have happened. I have a feeling it's because Damian Lee negotiated it, but kind of tell people about the interesting aspects of the fact that he did not get signed for next year.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, I mean, he just signed yesterday as we record this on Tuesday. It's just that I think he and his representatives wanted just the rest of this year and then to be a free agent at the end of the year, even though he'll be restricted because he's, you know, only been in the league one year. He'll at least be able to go out there and field other offers rather than being sort of non-guaranteed for the most of the year like Jalen Morris and Antonius Cleveland will be. So I think he just, you know, obviously he leveraged his starting position, you know, over the last few weeks. Now that Bazemore's been out, he leveraged that into something that he wanted, which is to be a free agent and possibly get out of Atlanta. We heard some rumblings at the end of his first 10-day that he might, you know, be out of there and he might go sign with another team. Now, at the end of the second 10-day, they were willing to pick him up for the rest of the year. But Lee was able to say, "Hey, I don't want to stick around for the remain. You know, I don't want to stick around for next year as well under your control. So, you know, I'm just gonna. I think he's looking to get out of Atlanta after his first year. It seems."
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Damian Lee is that he's 25. So if he's going to do something in the NBA, it's going to have to be pretty much now. So I could definitely see that. And listen, I mean, it's unquestionably better for the player to have his freedom. If you have a non-guaranteed contract for next year, the Hawks have all the cards. They can cut you, and then you'll become a free agent anyway. But it's one of those things where maybe Damian Lee or his agent thinks they can get a little bit more than the minimum, or maybe he thinks he can get a multi-year contract for somebody. I don't blame him for that. I think if I was in his spot, I would probably be trying to do exactly what they tried to do, especially at his age. So I understand it from the Hawks' perspective. They still have him restricted, and I can't imagine if they wanted to keep him, they wouldn't be able to. But at the same time, I don't know. Where are you at only as a player? I think because he's 25, my guard is up a little bit. I've liked what I've seen from him, but at the same time, he's shooting 27% from three. He needs to be able to make shots because defensively he's not the greatest thing in the world. So he's, out of all these prospects the Hawks have, he's probably the most offensive first when compared to Jalen Morris and Antonius Cleveland. He's probably the most offensive first guy, but he's going to have to make shots, or I just don't see it. So I think you and I were both impressed up with him a little bit when compared to other guys in his situation, but it's not like he's like going to blow the world on fire either. So I don't know. Where are you at on him as a player right now, as terms of just if the Hawks even want to hold on to him?
Yeah, I mean, I think the 27% from three is not – it doesn't feel representative of what his sort Agreed. Of skill level is from beyond the arc. I think he's probably a 38 to 40% three-point shooter, you know, especially you get him in a better system with – not a better system, but like just with better players around him. I think he'll take, you know, fewer sort of coming off of screens, taking fewer sort of on the move. Like they've been really sort of pushing his ability to do those things just because – you know, they can, and they've got the bandwidth to give him lots of different kinds of opportunities. And he's not coming through on all of those, but he's coming through on enough of the like standstill knockdown 3-point shots that I feel good about his offensive game. You know, the defensive game's not fantastic. I mean, he's probably better than Tyler Dorsey on that end. So there's that.
Yes.
But
agreed.
You know, at least he's not so bad that it's like, oh my God, we cannot play this guy on defense. He's fine. It's not fantastic, but I think he's okay. And you know, whether he becomes restricted this summer or not is going to be interesting, because they would have to give him a qualifying offer for like $200,000 more than the minimum, which he might take.
I
and
think
so they might, they might have to do that way. And if not, he's unrestricted and he can go sign with whoever he wants. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see that little dance there. And the Hawks will have some cap space this summer, but probably will want to use that to take on bad contracts along with draft picks, like a lot of bad teams do. So, you know, eating up $200,000 of that cap space, you know, might not be something they want to do. And then Lee gets what seems to be his wish in getting out of Atlanta, just because of sort of the rumors that he was out of here after the first 10-day contract. And then now obviously he was unwilling to sign for a second year, even partially guaranteed or even fully guaranteed. They were unable to come to an agreement on that. So it seems like Lee is not long for Atlanta past the next week and a half or so.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that for sure. And of course, it's a lower level thing. Obviously, a lot of fan interest on that, which it's kind of only for diehards that care about this stuff. But I want to at least get it out there because it was pretty interesting, the machinations behind that. Other quick note is that Jeremy Evans is now on the Atlanta Hawks roster for a 10-day contract. The 30-year-old is a former slam dunk champion with the Utah Jazz. He's actually in the G League right now, which is interesting. A very rare thing where a 10-day guy goes to the G League, but the G League team, the Erie BayHawks, are in the playoffs right now. So Josh Magette is down there. Andrew White is down there. They've got every reason to, I guess, try in the G League playoffs right now. So they have all their guys that could be around, including Evans, who's been in Erie most of the season. So I don't really have much to say about Jeremy Evans. He's not a prospect. He's 30. He's not really an NBA player at this point in time. But if you had to just have a body around, the Hawks want bodies around. They needed them because of all the injuries. I don't hate it or anything. It's just one of those things where I probably would have liked to have seen the Hawks take a shot on a guy who actually has an NBA future, whereas Evans doesn't. But I don't know. I'm not upset about it at all.
Yeah, I think this might be one of those things that's a reward for his play at the G League level. It might be a reward for sticking around with Erie when I don't think he had to, or they had to trade for him or something like that. Something weird happened with his contract coming out of training camp and then coming into the G League. So it feels like this might be just a, hey, we'll give you a 10-day at the end of the year. They had the extra roster spot because of the hardship exception. So they didn't have to, cut anybody for it. They could have taken a flyer, a 10-day flyer on somebody else, but they've got so many flyers that they're taking right now, and they're trying to evaluate so many different guys that it's, if you're throwing out five guys that you're all trying to evaluate within your system, but nobody really knows the system very well, it's going to be very hard to sort of understand, how this guy fits. But if you have one or two of those guys on the court at a time, you can sort of get a feeling for how they fit with the rest of the team. And so, having so many guys that you're taking flyers on is great, just to, play the lottery as many times as you can. But it is, at a certain point, there's a breaking point there where you're just throwing guys out there and there's no real synergy. There's no way of knowing whether they're really fitting in with their teammates or not.
Yeah, that's a good point, to be sure. And the Hawks still have a very full injury report. They have four guys out for sure on Tuesday against the Heat, and then another. And Tonius Cleveland's actually been upgraded to doubtful, so we might actually see him pretty soon after, many Hawks fans have gotten jokes off about Cleveland and his inability to play when the Hawks signed him. But he actually might play before the end of the year, if this is any indication. And so lots to monitor in terms of that little stuff in the last four or five games here. Before we get out of here, man, I do want to ask you about John Collins as sort of a big picture thing. Everything else that we've done on this pod has been kind of newsy in terms of just checking in on guys. But Collins, we haven't talked about a ton, which is a weird thing to say. We spent a ton of time recently focusing on Torian Prince because of his explosion, whereas Collins hasn't really done anything, individually explosive in terms of just, a huge box score game or something like that. Or, he had a little bit of an injury that he was battling, but he's now healthy and has been hanging around, playing a lot, but nothing exceedingly noteworthy. I want to just ask you where you think you are on him now after this stretch, because he is playing more minutes. In March and April, he's now up to almost 30 minutes a game because of all the injuries and the fact that he's just one of the only healthy guys around, and of course every reason to play him. But what have you seen from him in this most recent stretch?
I think he's getting better, especially on the defensive end. He's more active as a weak side shot blocker. He's understanding rotations better. He's just rotating over earlier. He's recognizing things, just all the things that you would hope would come with experience, but don't always, that doesn't always happen for big guys. It's just little things like that is good, are good to see. But I think, it's hard to project him out long term. I still, I'm still in the mode that he's a bench guy in the long term, just because, unless he has some sort of extra offensive step that we haven't seen yet, either as like a playmaker off the elbows, which they've thrown him out there a little bit in those situations, or as just like a step out, 3-point shooter, obviously that would help his offensive game a ton. So like one of those two things kind of, for me, has to emerge over the next, he's got some time, so it's not like he needs to emerge that by this summer, but it would be nice to start seeing growth in those areas so that the Hawks can really plan out, okay, this is a long-term starter for us. I would say going into this draft, if there's a center or a power forward that they really love at the top of the draft or even later on in the first round, they should go ahead and take that. I don't think Collins is like absolutely the center of the future or anything like that, but he's been obviously much, much better than expected when he came into Atlanta. But there, I still, tempering expectations a little bit would probably be smart with him. I don't think that I still see him long term as the first big off the bench kind of guy.
Yeah, I think your point about the draft is a good one, in that I wouldn't be avoiding a big man because of Collins. Even with that first pick, I wouldn't be avoiding a big man because of Collins. I do think some fit stuff matters as a tiebreaker, but nothing else beyond that. I think I'm projecting him as a starter moving forward. At the same time, I don't think it's a lock, which is what you're saying, and I don't think that it's necessarily a situation where you're building around that guy. So I think I'm probably a little higher than you are. At the same time, I think I'm lower than a lot of the fan base is, that is, as you kind of alluded to there, penciling him in as a foundational piece moving forward. He certainly could be that. I think there's a path to that if there's development defensively and or with the jump shot. At the same time, I don't think it's a lock. What we've seen, though, is that he is definitely a quality NBA player, which is good. I mean, if you get that guy at 19, that's a huge win. Even if it's in a bench role, like you said, or in a third big role, if you have a quality guy there, that's a home run with that pick. It's not a grand slam or anything like that, but at the same time, I think we've seen a ton from him. I've been very impressed with what I've seen from Collins, and there is a path. And by the way, I do think he's a center, which is interesting. I think you pointed that out as well. But there are ways where you could pair him with another big where he would technically be the power forward. I'm not as firmly in the he's an absolute center camp as I was coming into the NBA, because I think he's been a little bit better away from the basket than I would have projected. At the same time, if he's not playing full-time center, he's going to have to get a lot better at some things on the perimeter, including shooting. Because if he's you know, we've seen some flashes with the jump shot, but if he's going to be a full-time or at least semi-full-time power forward, he's going to have to make shots. And I'm not sure that he's going to do that, but we'll see. So a long way to go there. He's 20, so I'm not worried. If anything, I'm less than worried about John Collins than I would ever have been a couple of months ago. So if you pair him with Jaren Jackson Jr., you pair him with Marvin Bagley, you pair him with DeAndre Ayton, you pair him with Mo Bamba, there are ways to do that. I wouldn't be avoiding anybody in the draft based on Collins. And some of that is because of Collins' versatility, which is a good thing, because he is a great athlete. He is somebody that can play power forward. He's played a ton of power forward this year. A lot of the best minutes at power forward have been with Dwayne Dedmon, though, and that's because Dwayne Dedmon can shoot threes, at least the new version of Dwayne Dedmon. So if you are pairing him with the center long-term and you want to play power forward, either he's gonna have to make shots, or it needs to be somebody like Jackson who can step out and shoot it, or even Bagley. We've seen a little bit of that from Bagley as well. So I don't want to get too deep into the draft stuff, but yeah, it's one of those things where I think he's going to be a starter long term. How good of a starter is up for debate, and there is certainly a scenario in which you would like to have him as a third big on a championship or contender level team versus what the Hawks actually are now. But we're getting way ahead of ourselves, obviously, and that's a few years away before that actually becomes a legitimate concern. Anything else you want to get out there before we look ahead quickly at the rest of the schedule? Because, I don't know, I mean, there's a lot to hit on. I think we've probably done a decent job of catching everybody up after a week-long absence. But if there's anything else that I've missed that you want to get out there, please fire away.
I mean, I think we talked about Bazemore when he got hurt. We'll talk about Bazemore more as the season comes to a close and the way that Taurean Prince has sort of stepped into that role. But we've got time to get into that on another show. Obviously, this was we covered a lot of different stuff on this one, so we can get into that later. Obviously, Prince has filled up the box score a little bit, but has had some of the issues, that you would expect stepping into Bazemore's role.
Yeah, to be sure. I think we've done a ton on Prince, and we'll do more, of course, because he's one of the few guys that you know is going to be around, barring some trade for a while now. Five games remaining. The Hawks have a back-to-back against the Heat on Tuesday, or tonight as you're listening to this, and Wednesday, road, home, back-to-back, and then they go on the road to face Washington and Boston before finishing with Philadelphia. If you had to guess, is there a win in there, or do the Hawks lose their last five?
There's probably isn't a win in there.
I don't think so either, just because Miami's trying. Like, Miami is the worst team of those five. Maybe Boston right now, because of Boston's injury stuff, would be worse than Miami, but it's at Boston, and Boston's going to have some reason to try, I think, in that game. I guess there is a scenario in which the Celtics just shut everybody down because it's late, and they might be locked into that two seats, and maybe they wouldn't have a ton of incentive to play in that spot, but still on the road. Sunday afternoon game, maybe things get weird there, but yeah, I'm kind of with you. I think 22, maybe 23. I can't imagine the Hawks winning more than one game down the stretch.
Yeah, it doesn't seem likely that they win more than one, but one, I guess, if you added up all the probabilities, maybe there's a win in there, but it seems like they obviously won't be favored in any of them, even if Boston sits most of their top guys. We've seen how some of their lower level guys have stepped it up in a big way. Obviously Brad Stevens is one of the best coaches in the game, maybe one of the top three or four coaches in the game, and obviously that's because of the culture there. That's because of the way that everybody tries no matter what, and it's I think that they're a good team, and even if they're missing their top three or four guys, we've seen them be able to take down teams even much better than the Hawks with missing those guys anyway. So it wouldn't surprise me if Boston, even if they're missing a bunch of guys, is able to take down the Hawks.
Yeah, same with Philly in that final game. I guess there's every reason to think that Philly could shut guys down too if they had no incentive to win. But and that's a home game, so that might be one that the Hawks, unfortunately, if you're a tanking enthusiast, may go out and win. And by the way, 538 projects 23 wins, so they see a win somewhere in there, which is the percentage play. I mean, five games, even if you're a big underdog in all five, the percentages probably add up to the fact that you get one. We'll see. And by the way, in terms of the tanking race, Phoenix has kind of put the pedal to the metal. They've lost 15 games in a row. It looks as if they're going to be the team with the most ping pong balls, and the Hawks are in this group with Orlando at 22 wins and Memphis at 21 wins and Dallas at 23 wins. So I think it'd be a pretty big shock if the Hawks fell out of the top five in terms of ping pong balls. I think if you are a rooting interest there, though, you want them to be in the top three in terms of lottery odds. So, you know, we'll have plenty of time to talk about that between, you know, April 10th and May 15th in terms of the lottery. But just something to monitor there. And the Hawks don't have a single easy game down the stretch. They're playing five consecutive playoff teams, including this back-to-back against Miami. So, anyway, want to put that out there. By the way, the Hawks are 11.5-point underdogs against the Heat on the road on Tuesday. So that tells you everything you need to know about that game.
Yeah, pretty much. The odds would probably say that they could maybe pull out a win in one of these, but you know, being double digit,
they have two home games. They're better at home. I mean, the Hawks are 16-23 at home, which is not good, but it's quite respectable when compared to their road record.
Yeah, that's for sure. But it seems like, you know, it also seems like maybe the at a certain point that Schlenk might step in and be like, hey, we're gonna sit a couple of these guys down the stretch here, even the guys who. Maybe even like a Torian Prince or a John Collins if he retweaks his ankle or something like that. But you know, even as constructed, they're going to be double digit underdogs in every one of these games, and even the home games, I would imagine they'll still be
close to that. Yeah, I think the only it's a good point that you brought up that I probably should have said as well is that I think a guy like Dwayne Dedmon could be a shutdown candidate at some point. Maybe not shutdown, but maybe a day off just to preserve him. Prince as well, any veteran. I guess the only caveat there would be the fact that the Hawks have to have enough players to play, and with all the injuries they have, they can't shut down too many guys, or they're going to be in some trouble. But once the G League playoffs end, they'll have those four guys back, and while none of them are exactly sexy, they can certainly eat up minutes, and we've seen that a number of times with Majette and Morris and Andrew White. Those guys you wouldn't want, if Morris comes back, I should say. But you know, there's enough minutes to go around if everybody's back from the G League. But I think Dedmon would be the guy I would circle as sort of the only vet that's around that's playing big minutes right now. He would be the guy I think would be the first I would sit if I was doing that myself.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Anyway, well, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it, man. Please plug your stuff. I know you got a lot going on always, so tell people where they can find your stuff, man.
You can follow me on Twitter at JG Siegel. You can find pretty much everything that I write on there. Hawk stuff over at Peachtree Hoops, Cavaliers over at Fear of the Sword, Trailblazers over at Blazers Edge. Everything else for now is at the Step Back, but I've got some stuff cooking there that I'm hoping to announce in the next week or two. So, you know, stay tuned for all of that as the playoffs start. I'm going to be moving homes pretty soon here. So keep your eyes on the Twitter feed. That's where everything goes down for me.
Absolutely. Follow Jeff. He's doing great work for us and for everybody else. So check his stuff out for sure. Thank you, sir, for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And for everybody else, we'll be back with a recap pod for the first time in a while. We'll be breaking down the Miami Heat game for Tuesday night into Wednesday morning. So stay tuned for that and subscribe to the podcast. Do all that fun stuff. We'll see you guys tomorrow.